Hi, Dan here. Due to our wordiness, we had to break up the podcast into two parts. So this is part two of our discussion on the 403B, which comes from podcast three of the year 2015. We continue the conversation on the 403B, including pre-tax contribution through a regular 403B and post-tax contribution through a Roth 403B. Scott also gives his verdict on my decision to cash out of my California teacher's pension last decade. Thanks. So, Scott, you mentioned before, you know, now we have this other layer of complexity in the decision-making process. Do you choose to have Roth contributions, which are after tax, or do you choose to do the traditional way people contributed to a 403B, which are pre-tax? Do you want to just kind of outline the pros and cons of those two tax treatments?
Yeah, it's... So the difference between a pre-tax and Roth, you know, so the pre-tax, when you take your money out, all of that is going to be included in your income as ordinary income. So you're going to have to, you know, potentially pay taxes on it. With the Roth, that grows tax-free, not tax-deferred. So when you take that money out at retirement, there is no tax consequence, which is very nice. Teachers, school employees, they tend towards... at least a lot of ones that I work with, they have a pension that's taxable. There's if they receive Social Security benefits, because they have that pension, a lot of their Social Security benefits are going to end up being taxed as well. Potentially up to 85% will be included in their ordinary income. And a lot of times their house is paid off, or maybe they're renting and so they don't get a deduction. And here you have all of your income is taxable. You have no deductions, your standard deduction, and now you want to take money out of a 403B, and it's all pre-tax as well. And so when you start taking money out of that 403B, it just increases your income even more, potentially exposing your Social Security to more taxes, maybe putting you into a higher tax bracket. So a lot of people think, well, I'm going to be in a lower tax bracket in retirement. And so... you know, I should put money into my 403B on a pre-tax basis, because if I put it in at a 25% tax bracket now, but when I'm retired, I'm only in the 15% tax bracket, I've got tax savings. And in the meantime, I've got growth on that money. The problem is a lot of teachers aren't actually in a lower tax bracket. They're in the exact same tax bracket in retirement as they were while they were teaching. I have this happen almost all the time. And so the you know, the benefit of that pre-tax, it goes away to some extent if you're going to be in the same tax bracket. It actually it doesn't, whether you're pre-tax or Roth, it actually ends up being the same benefit if your tax bracket stays the same. If you know your tax bracket's going to be low in retirement, pre-tax is the way to go. If you think you're going to be in the same tax bracket or higher, then you're going to want to look at doing a Roth. Mainly because the Roth gives you a little bit more flexibility. You don't get that big hit in terms of tax savings up front, but you get a nice tax savings down the road. And also it gives you a lot more flexibility in your planning years, because not everything you take out of your account is going to be taxed.
And, you know, you don't have, it's not an either or.
Right.
You just can't go beyond that threshold of $18,000 for 2015. So if you want to sort of hedge your bet, so to speak, you could do, you know, some of it into pre-tax, some of it into Roth. And do you have clients doing that, Scott?
Yeah, I do. Absolutely. And it's mainly so that they can have some diversification of income sources when they actually do retire.
And I like what you just said, you know, we think about, you know, diversity in how we allocate our investments, but I also think we need to increasingly think about tax diversity, and this is a prime way to achieve that.
Yeah, although I always tell my clients, by the time we actually start taking the money out, I'm sure there'll be a national sales tax.
Well, and you know what's funny, Scott? I just, you know, you just wonder if down the road they change Roth, you know? It's like we're all operating under rules that we hope will be in place in the future.
Exactly.
And so it is a leap of faith, and maybe divvying it up if you have the option between Roth and non-Roth is a way to sort of, you know, like I said, hedge your bets. All right, Scott, a couple more things here before we close out on the 403B. And I have a feeling we'll do other podcasts with, you know, more depth on certain aspects of the 403B. But okay, you're a teacher listening and you are going to separate from service.
What happens? You're a teacher working in one state. You're going to move to another state. What are your options for your 403B?
Okay. Well, it depends on your age. But you would, so once you've separated from service, you can roll, you can leave the money there if you want. So you can leave it in that 403B. If you like that 403B and it's good, it's low cost, then keep it. You don't have to do anything with it. You can leave it there. If you want to, you can roll it over to an IRA. An IRA is an individual retirement account. And basically, it's, you can invest in just about anything in an IRA. You can open your IRA wherever you want. So maybe your 403B in your current school district is not very good, but you still wanted to save for retirement, and so you did. You can actually roll that money right over to Vanguard in an IRA if you wanted to. And a lot of people do that, or any other company you desire. The other option is if there's a 403B plan or another retirement program offered at your new employer, you can actually do what's called a plan-to-plan transfer and move that money to that new plan over there if you think it's a good plan and it'll work for you. So you have, or you could take the money out. If you take the money out and just, you know, have them send you the money, it's all going to be taxed.
Yeah, don't do that.
Don't do that. It's ordinary income, and if you're under 55 when you do that, it'll be an additional 10% tax penalty.
So I'm just checking real quick. You know, I mentioned earlier that I started with Vanguard. Somehow, out of the 60 vendors available to me at when I worked at the Corona-Norco Unified School District in Southern California, 59 were high-fee variable annuity companies. I didn't have Tiercraft, didn't have Fidelity, didn't have T. Rowe Price or USAA. I somehow did have Vanguard. So I stopped teaching there in 2001. And Scott, I was able to keep my money right where it is in Vanguard. And I still have my original 403B. It's at Vanguard. And it is now at $70,000. $70,938. That's my first 403B. And I probably contributed maybe $25,000 to that. So you can see how it's grown. Okay, Scott, so that's great information on what happens if you separate from service. But let's say you're someone, you're gonna work maybe 25, 30 years. When can you, at the same school district, when can you access that money without penalty?
If you're still working?
If you're still working. Well, okay. A couple things, yeah. Let's say you're a teacher and you're thinking, how much longer do I have to work? When can I access it? What happens if I retire, or what happens if I'm still working? Maybe look at both scenarios.
Okay. So there's two key dates, age 55 and age 59 and a half. If you are, if you retire in the year you turn 55 or later, then you can have full access to your 403B without any penalties, without any tax penalties. Anything you take out will still be ordinary income. Now, it has to stay in that 403B structure. If you roll it over to an IRA, then you're in trouble, because that money is actually going to be taxed as ordinary income plus a 10% tax penalty if you take it out before age 59 and a half. The second date I mentioned is 59 and a half. If you've reached age 59 and a half, you can take money out of your 403B whether you're working or not. Now, the one caveat to that is your plan, the 403B plan your employer offers, does have to allow for this, what's essentially called an in-service withdrawal. Almost all of them do, but occasionally I come across some that don't, but it, almost they always do. So even if you're still working at age 59 and a half, you can begin taking money out of your 403B without any additional tax penalty.
And we've got, again, everyone's situation's different, but would you advise a client, you know, try to keep it in there as long as possible. Take advantage of that tax-deferred growth. Obviously, if you need it, that's a nice thing to have. Is there any thoughts around that?
Well, again, it does depend. And I do have some clients where it makes sense to actually begin taking those withdrawals earlier rather than later, if it allows another income source to grow. So for example, for some clients I have that have Social Security, the longer they wait to take Social Security, the bigger their benefit's going to be.
Mm.
And depending on the situation, if I can get them to wait to take Social Security at age 70, in the current environment, it actually makes sense to pull money out of a 403b or an IRA to live on or to supplement their income until the Social Security kicks in, because the Social Security will be so much higher. When it comes to teachers and teachers that don't pay into Social Security, it gets a little more muffled and it's not nearly as easy. But generally, you're right. Leaving the money in and letting it grow, the longer you leave it in and let it grow, the better you're going to be.
And Scott, you know, just kind of wrap that up, the idea of taking it without penalty. Excuse me. There's something called, if you're younger than 55, you can take substantially equal periodic payments, SEP. How does that work? So I'm 54, let's say. I'm actually only 49, but soon to turn 50. So let's say in a few years, you know what? I want to tap that that 403B. What are the rules for me, Scott?
It's so substantially equal periodic payments are essentially allow you to take money out before 59 and a half. And if you retire before age 55.
So you have to separate from service. You can't be with the employer anymore. So in my situation, I potentially could do that.
Yes. And what it does is you – there's a formula that goes into it. You basically have to take out a certain amount of money, basically the same amount of money over that time period. It's going to be different depending on what that time period is, but it has to last at least until 59 and a half or 5 years, whichever is later. So if you start these payments at 58, which doesn't really make sense because if you're 58, you should be able to. Well, let's say you retired at 54. But then wanted to start payments at 58. So you didn't qualify for that age 55 exemption. Well, if you want to take them over at 58, you would have to take them for 5 years, which puts you past age 59 and a half. So it's whichever comes later, 5 years or 59 and a half. I rarely see people do this.
Yeah. And I guess it's just nice to know that's an option for people. Maybe for one reason or another, they need to go ahead and get that money. Okay, we'll move on to just a couple other times that you might be able to access that. So if you become disabled, my understanding is you may be eligible for distribution. This option is designated by each vendor and not by the plan. So you would want to contact your vendor for more information. Do you have any clients who've been in that situation?
Fortunately, I haven't had any clients in that situation. That's a pretty rare one, although you do see it.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say it's difficult because it's not really disability is not well defined.
Yeah.
So that makes it tough to qualify for because employers just don't want to get hit with an IRS audit and show a distribution that really shouldn't have been a distribution. So it's a little difficult to actually qualify for.
The other one would be, which is, pretty cut and dry, I guess, would be divorce. Have you had clients who have been divorced, and how does the 403B get treated?
Yeah, unfortunately, I have seen this quite often. The 403B really depends on the divorce settlement. Typically, what comes out of a divorce settlement is what's called a quadro or a qualified domestic relations order. And this is really just a legal agreement that's set forth by the court. And if you have that in hand, you can actually split the 403B into multiple accounts so that the divorcing spouse, if it's part of the agreement, is able to have some of that money rolled over into their own IRA. So really what happens to a 403B depends on the divorce negotiations. There's no formula that's set out. It depends.
Okay. And what about hardship withdrawals? What can you say about those?
I don't have the reasons in front of me. Maybe you do. I'll have to double check here. But a hardship withdrawal is actually very simple under 403B rules. There are several things that qualify for hardship withdrawals, and they're actually laid out by the government. In some plans, they aren't laid out by the government, But they make it pretty easy with the 403B.
Yeah, I'm just looking at 403BYs, and what we say is, you know, these are permitted by the IRS. And I don't know, I think maybe who would you trust more, the IRS or the vendor, to make the decision? You know, in this case, the IRS decides they're not required to be made available, but you would contact the IRS in this case.
But they're not required to be made available. They almost always are. They're pretty cut and dry. You know, so for example, you could use ones to buy a principal residence, pay medical expenses, certain medical expenses. You could pay some college tuition. So there's a few very specific situations where they let you take hardship withdrawals, and the vendors are usually pretty good about it. As long as it falls within that purview, then they're good. You know, if you call up and say, you know, I need a hardship withdrawal because I need to bury my dog, probably not going to get it. It doesn't really fall under one of the rules.
Well, you mentioned one of the ones that I'm going to guess is probably the most popular is, you know, buying a home. As a, you know, from a financial planner standpoint, what do you think of that? Because I'm guessing that some of these sales agents, that's a selling point, you know? Hey, start a 403B. If you need to, you can borrow it, money for your house. What are your thoughts on that approach?
Well, generally, there's two different ways that people could potentially use their 403B to buy a principal residence. One would be to take a loan from the 403B, and then the second would be to take a hardship withdrawal. There's a certain amount that's allowed. Generally, the latter, taking that hardship withdrawal, is not the best way to go because you still have to pay taxes on that money when it comes out, and it's still subject to a 10% federal tax as well as potential state tax penalties. So you could end up, if you tried to take $20,000 out as a hardship, you may end up with $14,000 or less. And so it may not actually help you out that much because of all the taxable income it produces. Then again, if you're in a low tax bracket, it might be okay. Generally, a loan might be a better idea, but it just depends on again, I'm a financial planner, so I'm always going to say it depends on your situation.
Every situation is different.
There might be a situation where, hey, you know, the tax deduction that you're going to get from that house is going to make it much more affordable, your living situation, and, you know, maybe you can do a better school district, maybe it's a better area for your kids. You know, there's a lot of factors, both quantitative and qualitative, that go into this that might drive you to say, hey, you know what, that penalty is totally worth doing.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great example of the individualness of a lot of these questions. All right, Scott, this is cut and dry. What happens at death to your 403B?
As long as you can, well, not you, as long as your beneficiaries can produce a death certificate, and as long as they're actually named as beneficiaries, then there's a couple things that can happen. First of all, name a beneficiary. Whatever you do, make sure you name your beneficiary.
Scott, what does that mean?
Okay, so 403Bs, just like an IRA or a 401k, they will not transfer to whoever you want them to transfer to upon death based on what it says in your will or your trust. They're going to go by what's called a beneficiary designation. And very simply, a beneficiary designation is who you want to get your money when you die. So generally, the spouse is going to be the first named or primary beneficiary on someone's retirement account, and maybe the secondary beneficiary. So if the spouse also dies, it might be the kids. But generally, you want to name a beneficiary. Naming your estate is usually not the best idea, although that is a possibility. I just don't encourage it. What happens at death? That was the question. I completely lost track.
No one's sure, right? Heaven, maybe. We don't know.
I don't know.
Maybe not.
Yeah. Nobody has contacted me from beyond the grave yet, so I don't know. So basically, the beneficiaries are going to find, you know, they're going to produce a death certificate. And there's a couple things that can happen. Within a 403B, it's plan specific and product specific. Whether or not the money can be rolled over into an IRA in the name of the beneficiary. There's a few different things that can happen at death. It's really probably beyond today's discussion. It would probably be a pretty good discussion another time. But very simply, it's very easy to get money out of the 403B once somebody has died. You just have to be able to produce a death certificate and prove that they're the beneficiary.
Okay. Well, that's very important information. You know, I just became full-time at UNM and just signed up for their 403B, and they offer it through Tia Kreff, and they make it very clear, as you're signing up, the importance of naming a beneficiary. So I think that's pretty well spelled out as you sign up for these plans. All right, Scott, I think what we'll probably do in future podcasts, we'll dive into more specific aspects. And for sure, on the next podcast, we're going to look at, a situation which I still think a lot of people are in. Those are people who have pretty poor 403B choices. What should you do if you only have bad choices? And we're going to set up an interview. I was actually contacted last week. I mean, just very timely. A sixth grade teacher just outside of Buffalo, New York, my old hometown, named Joe Menudo. He contacted me about, hey, look, I don't like my choices. What should I do? So we're going to go ahead and interview him and see what his situation is all about. But if you want more information, obviously you can go to 403bwise.com. On the homepage, we have a tab called For Participants. If you click that and then click 403B info, you'll see all the information we have on the 403B. We also have a mobile version. So if you're on your phone and you just type in 403B Wise, it'll flip over to our mobile version. And then IRS has a publication. It's called IRS Publication 571. And it's titled Tax Sheltered Annuity Plans. And then in a parenthesis, it says 403B Plans. Scott, why do we have a problem with the title Tax Sheltered Annuity Plans?
Because it infers that the only type of 403B you can have is an annuity.
Yeah, and that's just not the case. It makes you think you have an annuity product. And as Scott pointed out, way back in 1974, which I think the United States was still involved in Vietnam, I think Gerald Ford was the president. So way back then, you could invest in mutual funds in your 403B. That's when that option was added. So this has been decades and decades that you can do 403B. So if there's anyone from the IRS listening and they have power, please get rid of that title, Tax Sheltered Annuity Plans. I will say, Scott, when I first started 403B, there was very few places to get information on the 403B. And one of the only ones was Publication 571. And you didn't even see the word 403B. So it's nice to at least see it kind of on the title. So maybe 5 years from now, we can eliminate TSA, Tax Sheltered Annuity Plans. Can you think of any other places to get 403B information? I guess 403bcompare.com, regardless of what state you live in, you can get information on various vendors. You know, my perspective is if it's offered in California, chances are it's probably offered in your state.
Yeah, no, 403bcompare.com is a great place to go. Where else? I mean, there's really no better place to find out things on 403B other than... Uh-oh, sorry about that, Dan.
It's all right.
Other than...
Hey, you're an important person. So,
you know, it's funny. I thought I had muted every single one of those notifications.
It's impossible to mute all our devices.
There's one more that I just don't know.
That's not your Apple Watch going off, is it?
Oh, well, actually, my Apple Watch did go off, but I was able to quickly hit the decline button on that phone call.
Oh, my gosh. Well, we'll save that for the next podcast. Talk about your Apple Watch. As an Apple stockholder, and I'm sure I've got lots of Apple stock in my various mutual funds, I want to discuss more what you think about Apple's growth prospects, because it's experienced enormous growth over the past decade. Can it continue? All right, Scott, let's move to the question that was raised in our last podcast in 2001. And I went back and looked at all these numbers and gave them to you. I taught in California for a total of 8 years. I was leaving the state. I was pretty sure I was not going to return to California, at least as a K-12 teacher. And I forget exactly why I came to this conclusion, but I decided to take my money out of CalSTRS, so out of my pension, and roll it over to protect, its tax sheltered status, and I rolled it over to Vanguard, and it was at the time $31,639. This was in 2001. Today, 14 years later, and I just checked, the account is worth approximately $97,000. Just to give you a little insight into how I'm allocating at least this account, $77,000 is in the Vanguard Total Stock Market Index. So basically all publicly traded American companies, so small, medium, and large companies. And the ticker symbol is VTSAX. And then $20,000 is in the Vanguard Total Bond Market Index, VBTLX. And I'm happy to report I'm eligible now for Admiral shares. So I'm paying for the total stock market index, Scott, I'm paying 0.05%.
Wow. And
then for the bond market index, 0.08%. I mean, those pretty fabulous fee structure. And again, I feel like I've got this total, pretty nice total, you know, in large part to, you know, the performance of the stock market over this time, but also the low fee structure. So, Scott, what have you found out about my decision? Was it wise? Was it unwise? Should I think about going back to California to teach? What did you come up with?
Well, first of all, I would love for you to come back to California to teach. I don't know if I want you to teach. Actually, I mean, who knows what crazy ideas you'd put into the mind of these young kids. But I'm just joking. I'd love to have you come back. So you were kind of fortunate to have received that money in what happened to be, you know, basically the middle of a, you know, a long kind of crash in the markets. In 2000, the markets started going down substantially. They fell from their high to their low, like something over 50% or close to it. I think mostly if you're in large cap growth stocks. But anyways, so it was a good time to be investing. You got your money at a really good time. And you were very smart about it. You did low-cost Vanguard funds, and you know they've grown substantially. I can't tell you exactly what your rate of return has been, but I know it's very close to around 9%. So you have had an average annual return of around 9% since that time, which I'm pretty sure is going to be very close, if not better, than what the California State Teachers Retirement System would have returned on that money. So I'm willing to bet if you were to redeposit that money at the state teacher's retirement system, you may not have to even deposit all of it. So I don't know that because we haven't submitted the paperwork to find that out. But what I wanted to do was just figure out, okay, what if instead you had left it on deposit at the state teacher's retirement system and just decided to retire when you hit your maximum age factor? So essentially the number that would get you the maximum pension if you never came back to teaching. And I think in a previous episode we talked about how CalSTRS, the California State Teachers Retirement System pension, works. It's your final salary times the number of years that you taught times what's called an age factor. And an age factor is just a number that's assigned, and the older you get, the higher your age factor. The highest that age factor can be is 2.4. So I just said, all right, well, what if Dan files for retirement at age 63 with his 8 years that he had and claims that 2.4 age factor? You told me that your ending salary, in this case, it'd have to be your ending salary, the average of your final 3 years, was about $65,000. So this is going to be the year 2028. The benefit that you would receive is $12,480 a year. So that's how much you would receive if you were to take that benefit over your life only. Now, if you wanted to provide for a spouse, so if you wanted to provide for Mandy, meaning you wanted to provide an income that you can't outlive, then the number is going to be that you and Mandy cannot live. Then the number is going to be $11,274.
Well, it's not much of a difference, really.
No, it's actually very small. It's only about $1,000, a little bit more than $1,000 over that time frame. It's about a 10% cut. in order to provide a lifetime income to Mandy. And what's interesting about that is I actually ran some numbers with this website called immediateannuity.com. It allows you to put in a lump sum and find out how much a typical insurance company would pay you for the, you know, the exact same thing, pay you over your lifetime. For just your lifetime, so if you were to take it just over, you know, as long as you're alive, it would pay you somewhere between $11,400 and $18,500. And let me actually take a step back here before I get into that. So you had a pretty darn good rate of return there, 9% a year. You invested during a good time. You held during the hard times, and the markets have been really good over the past 5 or 6 years. So it's grown well. The question is, how is that money going to perform over the next, I guess it would be 13 years? With an allocation at 70% stocks and 30% bonds, and with the markets where they're at today, a 9% rate of return going forward might be pretty difficult. I would, in fact, not expect you to get a 9% rate of return, no matter how good you are. I don't think Warren Buffett's going to get a 9% rate of return. But right now, you have 30% of that portfolio in fixed income that's probably earning 1-1.5%. And if interest rates move up, that could kind of put a damper on the returns there. And on the stock side, stock valuations are pretty high. Some people think that future stock returns are going to be pretty low, like in the 5% range. But let's just say that stocks do average 10% over the next 13 years. 70% of your portfolio is in stocks, so that's you're going to get about 7% there. And 30% of your portfolio is in bonds. I'd expect if we don't have any interest rate increases, that part's going to produce about another 0.5%. So if you're really lucky, after fees, you're somewhere around 7% with this portfolio if stocks do really well. So I tested three different numbers. What happens if you left your money, if you kept investing and you got a 5% return, a 7% return, and a 9% return? And at age 63, if you took that money and bought an annuity from XYZ insurance company, what would you get? Well, you would get about, if you only got a 5% rate of return, which again is a real possibility, over your lifetime only, the number would be $11,400 a month. Excuse me, per year. There's a big difference there. So that number is actually just only a little bit higher than the annuity that CalSTRS is going to provide over both your lifetimes, you and Mandy's. I don't know if Mandy's comfortable with me mentioning her name, but I've done it like four times now, so I apologize in advance. So the other difference is that insurance company is not going to give you any inflation adjustments, whereas the CalSTRS benefit has built-in inflation adjustments. So if the best you can do is just 5%, then taking that CalSTRS benefit is actually going to end up being a better deal for you. Now, if you get 7% return, if you're lucky enough to get a 7% return, then they're going to pay out $14,520 over your life only. Now, that's definitely better than either one of the amounts that I mentioned for CalSTRS.
But not inflation adjusted, right?
But it's not exactly. It's not inflation adjusted. And if you wanted that benefit to be provided for you and your spouse over both of your lifetimes, it gets reduced by 21%. So it's only going to be $11,500, which is just a tad above what CalSTRS would provide. And CalSTRS is going to be adjusted for inflation. So if you're going to provide it to your spouse, it really is not such a good deal. And that's with a 7% return. So it really, when you bring your spouse into it, it really does kind of change the numbers here. CalSTRS is giving a really good deal to provide a spousal benefit, whereas the insurance companies are not. Now, finally, if you are able to get a 9% rate of return over the next 13 years, which would be awesome, then you could go out to an insurance company and they'll probably pay you $18,500 a year as long as you're alive. You know, that's 50% more than the top benefit that CalSTRS would pay you. Again, it's not adjusted for inflation. But if you want to provide it over your spouse's lifetime, it drops again by 21% to around $14,600, which is only marginally better than you know, what CalSTRS is going to provide, that $11,200 benefit. I know I just threw out a whole lot of numbers, but the bottom line is you're going to have a really high rate of return between now and 2028 to have a chance at generating an income that is better than CalSTRS, whereas the CalSTRS is a guaranteed amount. And I really don't think I'm skeptical that we're going to be able to get a 9% rate of return, which is really the only one that comes close to competing with the CalSTRS options. So overall, you know, was it a good decision? We need to wait 13 more years to find out. But again, you know, over those 13 years, you're going to be taking a substantial amount of risk, whereas the CalSTRS benefit is completely guaranteed. No matter what happens in the market, you would have gotten this over your lifetime and Mandy's lifetime, $11,274 a year with some sort of inflation adjustment. So from a risk return standpoint, the CalSTRS benefit was probably going to be better for you. And that just demonstrates how difficult it is, even when you do incredibly well on your own investing, to mimic the same benefit that CalSTRS was going to provide you. And the main reason, we talked about this last show, is because you don't get the benefit of the employer contributions that were made into it and the growth on those. And I think that is the big difference, as well as the fact that you don't take as big of a hit for providing for the spouse as you do with an insurance company annuity.
Wow, Scott, that's some great information. You know, it makes me feel like, as you said, I probably did as well as you could do over that period of time. And it does seem like that might have been a mistake now in hindsight. So a couple things. What if I was to return to California, teach for 3 years, and I don't even know what the salaries would be now? What would you say to something like that?
Well, so would this be returning to California now and teaching for 3 years, or returning a decade from now and teaching your final 3 years?
You know, maybe even split the difference, say 3 to 5 years from now, let's say.
That would be a little more. I didn't run, of course, that's not the number I ran, Dan. So,
and this would be off the top of your head. I guess, you know, whatever numbers you ran, and it would be.
The bottom line is it would pay off big time. I mean, even if you just dropped everything and went and taught right now, you would end up doubling your benefit. And so you come to California, teach 3 years, and then go off and do whatever you want to do for the next decade, and then you retire. Your benefit will be twice what I just told you it was.
Wow. And that starting at age 63 compared to, you know, I also, and in Social Security, I guess that would be, the second thing that comes into this. You know, I've been out of the, you know, the California system for a while. So I've been paying, you know, heavily into Social Security for all this time. What impact would that have?
Well, that's going to depend.
Offsets, right?
Yeah, that's actually a great question for like a whole nother show that I think we're going to do on Social Security and teachers. So it really depends on how many number of years of substantial earnings that you have within Social Security. If you have enough years, there'll be no adjustments at all. You'll get your full Social Security benefit. If you don't have enough years, really anything below 21 years of Social Security earnings, then there's going to be an offset and your Social Security is going to get reduced. There's also going to be some restrictions on what kind of Social Security you could receive from spousal benefit as well and survivor benefits. All of that kind of plays into it. And teachers who teach in states that don't have Social Security but have a spouse that's in Social Security, there's things that affect them. Career changers, there's things that affect them. For you, I mean, we'd have to take a look at the numbers, but there's, you know, the possibility that you would have enough years in Social Security, or that you could potentially work enough years to where you wouldn't have your Social Security reduced. Mm. But that's not the norm with most teachers.
Well, Scott, again, thank you. I appreciate this, and I'll say it again to our audience. This is why you look to use people like Scott, certified financial planners who have taken the fiduciary pledge, who will put your interests ahead of their own. This is the kind of information, you know, I may have been able to get myself, but certainly not so succinctly and so quickly. So, Scott, thanks for providing that. Boy, you could make a great podcast if I do go back to California, right? That could be kind of interesting to see how that goes.
Yeah, that would be. I hope you come back, man. We need you.
Well, I'll bring my own water, right?
Well, yeah, of course.
It's funny. It's been raining a lot in New Mexico. All right, Scott, this has been a long podcast. We're at an hour and 30 minutes here. We might need to chop this thing up into a couple. All right, so we'll maybe come back to this question. You know, who knows, you know, my plans down the road, but let's get to three questions. We'll do this kind of quick. Scott, I'll go first. It sounds to me like you watched the television show The Americans. Do you pull for the KGB or the FBI?
Oh, boy. Well, I mean, Carrie Russell's so hot. How do you not pull for her?
So you have a looks-based patriotism. Is that what I'm to gather from this, Scott?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what you should get. It's like in Breaking Bad, you know, you don't want to vote for the guy who's supplying meth to, you know, potentially kids, but they're such likable characters, you know, they do such a great job, and they just believe so much in their motherland. You know, like you see their. I think what's interesting about the show, just like with Breaking Bad, you see a different perspective. And that's what I like about it. But I couldn't go for the KGB. Even though it's entertaining, I couldn't go with the KGB.
Yeah, I mean, part of me during the show is like, oh my gosh, when will they defect? You know, and it does seem like the husband, that is in the back of his mind. I think that's a future plot line.
Right.
But you know, again, we always have very much the American perspective, and you know, I've lived overseas and traveled overseas, and I'm very happy living in this country. But I do think the Russian experience, particularly, you know, what they faced with the German attack on the homeland and the casualties they took to their actual homeland, I think affected them profoundly. In which I'm not saying this is right, but this is why they wanted the satellite countries, the you know, the East Germanys, the Hungaries, the Czechoslovakias, and you can see why she is such a believer. But I think Philip, I think is the husband's name on the show.
Yeah.
There's an interesting, you can see, hey, look, this isn't so bad here. You know, we don't have rations. We don't have all these kind of things. Personally, I really like the characters. I like the interesting dynamic. Oh, you're only in season two though, right? So I'm not going to throw this out. Like, I just will say like, what about the kids? You know, these are kids that have no idea about their parents. So right. I think that will become a plot line in future episodes. All right, Scott, your turn.
Okay. If you could spend one day with Steve Jobs or Bill Gates, who would it be?
God, I really like this question, Scott, because I have completely changed my opinion on these two. I abhorred Bill Gates mostly because of his products. I thought, you know, when you compare the two, oh my God, night and day. You know, I'm someone who started off in journalism, went into education, so I had Macintosh products. I used the Mac SE. I don't know if you ever had one of those. You know, it was this small standalone computer. When my first job out of college, I was a reporter for a small magazine in Corona, California. We used to lay the magazine out on the Mac SE, and it was so user-friendly. And then when I would, you know, kind of play around with PCs, I'd be like, what the hell? This is like the Stone Ages, you know? So I always, you know, just liked Steve Jobs because of the products. And interestingly, a lot of people don't know this, Microsoft actually started in Albuquerque. Did you know that, Scott?
I did, but
maybe I told you that.
You told me so. Yeah.
It's great. The way I introduce primary sources to my students at the University of New Mexico, I've got a police report from an accident that Paul Allen and Bill Gates were in Albuquerque in 1977. And so, and it's funny because I don't tell them what it is. I just give it to them and I say, okay, what kind of document is this? What kind of information does it show? And they start looking through it and it doesn't say Bill Gates. It says William Gates. And it's interesting. He has written Microsoft. It's anyway, he didn't write it. It's a police report, but he has told the police officer the term Microsoft and it's hyphenated Microsoft. These guys drove a green Porsche. And it's funny. Some of the students are like, William Gates, William Gates. Wait, is that Bill? Maybe I heard something, especially people that grew up in Albuquerque. And some are like, yeah, he grew up there. No, it's much more complicated than that. He came out there to work for a company that started called MITS that started the first affordable computer at that time. And Paul Allen actually preceded him, worked for the company. They actually formed Microsoft in Albuquerque in one of the museums in town. They have their business license from 1975. So anyway, I read the biography about Bill, about Steve Jobs, and Steve Jobs was an awful human being. To me, he was basically a Microsoft computer, an awful thing. Whereas Bill Gates, what he's done post-Microsoft, you know, with his foundation and his attention to poverty and disease and education. So very long-winded answer. Obviously, I couldn't spend time with Bill Gates, with Steve Jobs. I kind of think he'd berate me and yell at me because that's sure as hell the way he seemed to treat the people closest to him. So I would pick Bill Gates. And if you had asked me that 5 years ago, I would have given you an opposite answer.
Well, I'd still pick Steve Jobs. I just finished the second biography written by the guy from Fortune. I can't remember his name. And there were some people who were not entirely happy with the Walter Isaacson biography because it portrayed Steve Jobs exactly as what you're saying. And while he was definitely like that in his earlier days, he wasn't nearly like that. In fact, he wasn't like that at all in his final decade at Apple. He was a completely different person. You know, he still tended to his moments, but he wasn't that guy who would just say crazy whatever was on his mind and walk into a meeting with his bare feet. So I think it wasn't as nuanced as it really could have been. And the people so Tim Cook, Eddie Q, all the people who surrounded him, Johnny Ive, you know, in the last decade, they all said, if Steve Jobs was the guy that was portrayed in Walter Isaacson's book, there's no way we would work for him. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't be here. We would not be here. Tim Cook offered Steve Jobs his liver or his pancreas, whichever one that he needed. He offered it to him. I wouldn't offer that to a guy who was like this, the way it was described. So they never would have actually gone on the record with another reporter had Isaacson's book not really portrayed Jobs the way it did. So I don't think Jobs is as bad as maybe Isaacson made him out to be, although I did find the book very interesting. And we never got to know what Steve Jobs would have done with his money because he didn't make it long enough. Maybe he would have been a bigger philanthropist than Bill Gates. Maybe he would have been a better, more elegant one. But that's not to say that what Bill Gates is doing is not just absolutely amazing. And I have a lot more respect for him than I think I probably did before. And I love Paul Allen just because he owns the Portland Trailblazers and the Seattle Seahawks. So with that, I would go Steve Jobs. And I encourage you to read that second book. It just came out like a month ago.
I need to check that out. All right, Scott, my turn. Cars, new or used?
I guess it depends on the car, but I mean, the better deal is definitely going to be buying the used car and keeping it for 8 years. Depends on financing, but if you're paying cash, I mean, you know, a new car, it drops so much in value the minute you drive it off a lot. So I would say that unless it's a Tesla, then buy a brand new Tesla.
Well, Scott, what's your philosophy? Do you buy cars new and keep them a long time, or does it sort of vary?
It varies. My next car will probably be a used car. My last car was brand new. My last three cars were brand new, but they were all specific reasons for them, mostly related to business. And to the deal that I got. So the last car I bought was a Chevy Volt, and I had to buy that brand new in order to get the tax credits. So that, I mean, that paid for itself very simply. But my next car will be a used car.
Interesting. And, you know, we've got two cars right now. We have an Odyssey that is now 10 years old. And I, you know, we've got 170,000 miles. I think we can probably get another 2 years out of it. Excuse me. And then we have a Prius, which we also bought brand new. And, you know, my dad, one of his fishing buddies, owns a dealership in Amarillo, Texas. So I actually, it felt like I was adopting a child. I flew into Amarillo, picked up my Prius, and we've been very happy with it. But, you know, it's interesting. We probably at some point need to replace the Odyssey. And I'm thinking, too, about, you know, probably going used. I mean, $35,000 for a car, that's a lot of money. So I'm with you on that.
All right. Cool. All right. Well, here I've got one more. I have two more questions, but mine is, all right. I can't wait to hear your answer on this one. So if you were trapped on a deserted island, who would you rather be trapped with? I can't even say it. Okay, who would you rather be trapped with? Sarah Palin? Or Justin Bieber?
Okay, I'm tempted to say Sarah Palin because she would say we can see Russia from here, and then at least we'd have an idea where we are, and then maybe that could lead to our rescue. Or Justin Bieber. Huh. I'm going to probably, at least he's got talent. I'm probably going to say, well, she is a woman. Oh, let's hope our wives are not listening to this. You know, how long am I stranded?
I don't know. You're going to be there for at least a month or
two. That's really good. You know, probably from the male factor, I'm probably going to pick Sarah Palin. But from the entertainment standpoint, I think Justin Bieber, he could at least sing, even though I really don't like his music. That is a brutal question. I'm going to work very hard to put you in a similar pretzel. How would you answer that question, Scott?
Is that part of the game where you
good
have to
you.
Answer?
That's a smart answer.
I'm going to say it's your turn to ask me a question.
Okay. Do you and your wife have a list? I'm just kidding. All right, Scott. Fresh Off the Boat or Modern Family?
Ooh. If I had to say for current season of Modern Family versus first season of Fresh Off the Boat, it would be Fresh Off the Boat. Overall, I'd say Modern Family.
Yeah, I mean, I think the staying power of Modern Family is phenomenal. I have yet to see a bad episode. It along with Fresh Off the Boat is one of those few shows that me at 49, my wife at 43, my daughter at 17, and my son at 10, we all totally enjoy. And there's not a lot of shows like that.
True.
But I think Fresh Off the Boat's really good. I hope it continues. It sounds like Eddie Wong, you know, who wrote the book and is involved in it, is not happy with the way it's come out.
Really?
I saw an interview with him on Bill Maher last week, and he doesn't seem very happy, you know, kind of the way it's portrayed. But anyway. All right, Scott, it's your turn. And boy, are the questions going to get harder?
No, this last one
that was a good
very,
one.
Very easy one. No hard choices. Either answer is going to be, I think, pretty good. Seinfeld or Friends?
Seinfeld. Actually, I would say that pretty strongly. I watched both. You know, Mandy got me the Seinfeld DVD set, and we've been watching it. And my God, that show holds up really well. And I'm sure Friends does, but I think Seinfeld just probably one of my favorite shows.
Do you watch Curb Your Enthusiasm?
I do.
So Seinfeld or Curb Your Enthusiasm?
That's a good question. You know, Curb Your Enthusiasm, it's almost uncomfortable to watch.
Oh, incredibly uncomfortable.
It's just partially because of what Larry David, the situations he puts himself in. But sometimes I feel like I've done that to myself as well. I feel like there's a little Larry David in me, so I can. Sometimes it hits home a little bit.
I love Curb because it gets. I mean, since it's on HBO, there's no topic is off limits, true, and they can say whatever they want, and it's brilliant. It's brilliant. I love it. If I could only watch Friends or Seinfeld or Curb. I think I would probably go Curb.
Okay. I think there's definitely something to be said for that. I think there, well, again, you know, Seinfeld's now sort of locked in, what, 1996? Is that when it stopped?
You know, like no cell phones or like those, you know, brick cell phones and, you know.
Yeah.
Like most of all their situations could be solved if they just had a cell phone.
I know, that's right. That is very true. Yeah, it's funny to go back. You know, I think of the Brady Bunch, right? Remember when they were lost in the cave and the popcorn? I guess, though, if they had AT&T, they still would have used the popcorn, probably. All right, Scott. So let's hold off any cool products or shows to the next one since we've gone so long on this. Scott, if somebody wants to contact you, how would they contact you?
Well, they can go to my website, meridianwealth.com. They can call me at, I don't know, should I give my number out?
You know, I wasn't going to give out my number. How about your Twitter handle?
Yeah, my Twitter handle is @MeridianWealth.
And then you said your website. Do you want to say your email address?
Yeah, just scott@meridianwealth.com.
Okay, and as far as reaching me, you can dan@403bwise.com. My book is called teachandretirerich.com, and you can follow me on Twitter @teachretirerich. There's no and in that. Not enough characters are permitted for that. So, Scott, this was a pretty long podcast. Hopefully, we provided some good information. But thanks again for joining me, and I hope you have a good time in Hawaii. Maybe we'll even do a podcast from Hawaii.
Hey, that would be cool. I think that'd be fun to do.
All right, Scott, take care, my friend.
All right, you too.